From Cited Media, this is Darts and Letters. I'm Gordon Caddick. Darts and Letters is a podcast about arts and letters, but for people who might hack a dart. We're a left-wing show about ideas, about academia, and sometimes about... Operator culture is everywhere. That's a military term. It refers to forces that fall under the purview of the U.S. Special Operations Command. I'm talking about the so-called elite special forces, the Rangers, Green Berets, and Navy SEALs. Operators are real-life superheroes, or at least they are to many people who fanboy over them. They're also kind of an online subculture. You know these people when you see them. They're gun fanatics. They're people who have Punisher stickers. They drink Black Rifle coffee. They wear khaki pants and bulletproof vests to protests. January 6th had a lot of these operator fanatics. Some of them are scary, but a lot of them are just nerds. Gun nerds, military nerds, and spy nerds. These are people LARPing like their favorite operator superhero. The cream of the operator crop are the U.S. Navy SEALs. The frogmen, as they were once known. Before 9/11, it seemed like the SEALs were kind of small and insignificant, but after 9/11, their ranks exploded. They became a key part in the global war on terror. Their work used to be in the shadows, but not anymore. My God, they're everywhere. This is the least clandestine fighting force there is. According to the New York Times, there have been over 100 books published by former SEALs since 9/11. 100. Navy SEALs are also frequent Fox News commentators, and they've become successful politicians. The list of former SEALs turned politicians is pretty long. You have Dan Crenshaw, the Texas congressman, Eric Gritans, the governor of Missouri, Ryan Zinke, that's Trump's Secretary of Interior, and there are many others. In fact, there's even a U.S. Navy SEALs political super PAC. How did we get to the point where the frogmen became so popular? Well, I'm sure there are many factors, but let me submit to you one. A video game. I think this was the SEALs' real coming out party. SOCOM U.S. Navy SEALs.
Come on, guys, this is our chance.
Are you gonna flank left?
All right, man, let's take him out.
The game was released on the PlayStation 2 less than a year after 9/11. I played it as a teenager and I loved it. I loved the stealth and the strategy. You'd play with a small squadron and you'd have to really carefully plan each of your moves. And you do it over a headset, which was pretty new. I thought it was really cool. Sony marketed it as a hyper-realistic tactical shooter. In their first TV ad, they portray a group of teenage boys losing on SOCOM to actual Navy SEALs.
Who are these guys?
Like shooting fish in a bucket.
SOCOM, U.S. Navy SEALs, now playing online.
The game had extensive consulting from the Navy. It used motion capture on the SEALs, and it even integrated some of their faces. This was basically a glorified ad campaign. The Navy didn't pay for the game's development, but it was a former military contractor-turned-game dev who designed it. And clearly, he gave his old benefactors everything they wanted. There's even a recruitment push built into the instruction manual and a mini-documentary in the game itself.
When it comes to action and challenge, few jobs are as demanding or intense as being a U.S. Navy SEAL. The workplace on the move.
SOCOM U.S. Navy SEALs played into developing this myth of the SEALs as our most elite and honorable operators. More recently, the truth of who they are has been starting to trickle out. There's been great reporting about the culture in the SEALs, about how they're sociopathic sickos who pose with corpses, how they murder innocents, and how they're strange QAnon conspiracy theorists. But I don't think these stories are ultimately going to have the kind of impact that the game did. The game was wildly popular, and it's already done its damage. I don't think there's any turning back. Operator culture is here to stay. Because in addition to SOCOM, it was so many other games. We are just steeped in this. There was a boon in war games post 9/11. Call of Duty, Medal of Honor, America's Army, Battlefield, Full Spectrum Warrior, Tom Clancy's Splinter Cell, and many others. These are some of the most popular games. You might think this is just because we liked it. After all, I liked SOCOM. It was a great game. So maybe the market was just reflecting our preferences. But as we'll see in this episode, it's a lot more complicated than that. These aren't just market commodities. Games are conscious political decisions. In fact, the earliest games were basically spin-offs of military products developed by public money at public universities. And this dynamic has only accelerated. The Department of Defense spends billions to create games by, with, and sometimes for the military. This public largesse has created a new digital militainment industrial complex. The games drive recruitment, they help training, and they make war fun. They make war seem like a game to us and to our soldiers. In fact, some drone operators even use Xbox controllers. In short, the government has militarized gaming and gamified war. So today on Darts and Letters, we look at our war games. Tanner Murley studies the political economy of media. He looks at American culture and sees cultural imperialism. Today, he's an associate professor at Ontario Technical University and author of the book Hearts and Minds, U.S. Empire's Culture Industry. But his interest in popular culture started a long time before that. It started in high school when he was working at Blockbuster, and it continued in through university when the war on terror was in full swing. It was there that Tanner realized that he needed to study media and war.
In the aftermath of the terrorist attack of 9/11, you see basically a media environment that starts, you know, marching lockstep with the Bush administration. The ideological environment was quite homogeneous, despite the sort of budding anti-war and peace movement that was emerging. But, you know, this happens sort of in the aftermath of the sort of great alternative globalization movements of Seattle, of Quebec, of elsewhere, that's sort of the high point of the movements in the 1990s, right? Where there's sort of dreams, there's another world is possible. Naomi Klein has published No Logo. This is sort of a milieu of sort of the new left social movements that come out of the end of history after the Soviet Union falls in 91. And it's a left that's trying to remake and reinvent itself. And it's gaining actually quite a lot of momentum. You see sort of criticisms of global capitalism. You see sort of criticisms of the role that the US state's neoliberal foreign policy is playing in shoring up and buttressing the spread of US-based multinationals around the world. There's a sort of new attentiveness to the degradation of workers around the world and the hyper-exploitation of people in export processing zones. And then all of a sudden, sort of there's this sort of the 9/11 terrorist attack, and the ideological environment changes radically. And people were very much just sort of in a state of shock, but also this sort of space for sort of radical imaginings of a different and better world seemed to sort of get ever more small. And it took a while for the sort of left to rebuild into the peace and anti-war movement that eventually emerged.
I'm curious about the kind of popular cultural milieu of the time. And it was a kind of extraordinary, you know, a show like 24 premieres, I think, like a month after 9/11 and has the kind of ticking time bomb as its whole premise. I mean, that was just like so perfectly tailored towards providing justification for the kind of politics that we saw, you know, the special operations, the torture. You saw that dramatized in one of the most popular TV shows of the time. And can you tell me a little bit about kind of the popular cultural milieu and what was that culture like?
24 is an interesting example. I mean, you see this kind of convergence or this intermingling of sort of the new global war on terror framing of reality that is being advanced by the United States and its allies around the world. You know, sort of this new state of exception or sort of all existing sort of norms and rules, you know, have got to go because, you know, the U.S. and its allies are being threatened and we need to sort of take up extraordinary means and measures to defeat, you know, terrorism. And you're seeing also video games. You're seeing things like World War II nostalgia games, like the Medal of Honor franchise, you know, and it's not sort of an explicit representation of the global war on terror, but it becomes kind of like a mode sort of by which people can plug into what they understand to be a good war and then imagine sort of in the present that the war on terror is also a good war. And you're also seeing some games like Desert Storm 2, Back to Baghdad, which is being launched literally sort of along the same timeline as the actual shock and awe campaign and attack of Baghdad in March of 2003. You've got all this weird stuff too happening. Like, you know, the shock and awe phrase sort of, I remember reading somewhere, like, you know, people are trying to take out like trademark applications for the phrase so they can make like t-shirts with shock and awe on it.
I didn't know that.
You know, shock and awe condoms. Like there's this kind of intermingling of like sort of macho militarism, masculinity, the war on terror slogans, like bowling balls, energy drinks. There's all of this stuff that's really just consolidating this very ideologically homogeneous media and cultural milieu, at least in the mainstream. And it becomes very difficult to pose questions about what's happening without being called a potential traitor or a terrorist sympathizer or someone that actually just might be a lunatic or a conspiracy theorist. It's very unusual because we can look back at the sort of, you know, war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan and just say that these just were outrageous, terribly consequential wars that were basically sort of, you know, sold to the public with a number of false pretenses. And that's not a controversial point to make, you know, in 2021. But at the time, if you're an anti-war activist or a peace activist, you know, you were very much perceived as a public enemy.
You're a scholar of cultural imperialism and critical political economy of communication. And I'm just curious, kind of in a kind of general way for people who don't know these sorts of disciplines, when you talk about these kinds of cultural products in the post 9/11 era, how much of that does the explanation sort of rest on the underlying ideological assumptions and convictions of the content creators, you know, the game designers, developers? And how much of that is kind of structurally baked in through like literal funding mechanisms or access to tanks and the necessary resources that kind of only the military can provide?
Yeah, that's a thoughtful question. I mean, there are many, many war-themed popular entertainment products that are circulating and available on the market today that have not in any way been shaped by the U.S. military itself. But there are also many sort of war-themed and military sort of themed media and entertainment products that have been shaped and supported and assisted by the actual real U.S. military. You have to remember that the people that are making movies, that are making video games, that are even making to the news some extent, aren't just sort of like, you know, freewheeling, completely autonomous agents that can do whatever they want, whenever they want to, report the world in exactly the same way that they wish, script the world of war in whatever way they like. These people are workers and workers that are employed by some of the most powerful, vertically and horizontally integrated media conglomerates on the planet. And so when it comes to then, I guess, entertainment that tells stories about the U.S. military or tells, you know, stories about war, there has for over 100 years been a, you know, pretty systematic effort on the part of the U.S. military and in particular its public affairs office to partner up with entertainment studios and to assist and support those studios making of these blockbuster films about war and these TV series about war. Every war that the United States has waged has been accompanied by a propaganda campaign. And of course, the state does not own or control, you know, the media or the culture industry. They're not comparable to what you'd find in an authoritarian society where they're, you know, the state usually exercises direct ownership and by extension control over what's fit to print and the kinds of ideas circulating. And so, you know, the state recognizes that. The state doesn't want to own and control, you know, Walt Disney or Facebook in the United States. But the state actually recognizes that because it's, you know, Walt Disney or Facebook that sort of millions of people will go to sort of, you know, accumulate or aggregate information about the world, especially the world of foreign policy. The state sees it as absolutely in its strategic interest to find ways of linking or partnering with these institutions, with these corporations, to shape the way that they may be telling stories about war and U.S. foreign policy. And so in the history of the United States, you know, you go back to World War I, this is sort of emerging with the Creel Committee of Public Information, which is the U.S.'s first official wartime propaganda agency. And it's at that moment where you have basically a positive relationship forged between the state, the military, and the emerging public relations, advertising, and entertainment industry in the United States. And you see these kinds of wartime combinations happen whenever the U.S. declares or engages in a major war.
I'm curious about, you know, these kind of early games starting in the 70s. And, you know, this is just like post-Vietnam, coming out of Vietnam and then going into video games. How does that maybe sort of set the scene for how the military would use the technologies?
The Vietnam War, of course, you know, relied upon the draft. And coming out of the Vietnam War, which was by many Americans, especially coming out of the 60s, the New Left, the Civil Rights Movement, the anti-imperialist movement, you have an entire generation of people that are very, very critical of the official rationalizations and justifications for the wars that the U.S. is engaged in. And you also have sort of a generation of people that refuses to fight on behalf of this nationalistic ideal, because, you know, many people have revealed that behind all of sort of that, basically the interests of corporations, of the 1%, and these wars are certainly not about spreading, you know, freedom and democracy around the world. And so following the Vietnam War, the military is facing recruitment challenges, and internally, it's asking itself, in the absence of a draft, how will we effectively, continuously enlist people? And so they start actually, you know, hiring a lot of public relations companies, of advertising companies, of social psychologists even, to say, you know, what will sort of be effective? How are we going to sort of, you know, change the way by which we sell the military itself to young people? And so the military basically undergoes like this rebranding process, and it starts finding sort of new ways to mobilize popular culture and entertainment as part of its recruitment arsenal. And video games at the time sort of become one way to do that. So, I mean, I recall reading stories about, you know, military recruiters, you know, who of course have monthly quotas or expected to recruit X number of people per month as part of their job's description or duty, you know, going down to sort of the suburban malls of America, you know, hanging around arcade games like, you know, Atari Battle Tank or whatnot, giving sort of kids some quarters and being like, hey, you know, you're a pretty good virtual shooter. You know, you really know how to handle that tank. Would you be interested in, you know, trying to drive a real one? And if so, okay, give me your contact information. Let's have a chat.
Yeah, war is fun. War is cool. You can be sort of a badass operator. That kind of ethos runs through a lot of these games and a lot of these kind of recruitment drives through video games. But how does that start? Like, what are the institutions that within the military that really kind of shape the early kind of prehistory of games?
In the Hearts and Minds book, The U.S. Empire's Culture Industry, I call this the DoD Digital Games Complex. And I see this as very much the institutional source of both commercially available and also sort of military sort of use war simulation games. And basically what I say is this DoD Digital Games Complex is like structural alliances and institutionally observable symbiotic relationships between the Department of Defense and its different agencies and like and you know, for-profit, you know, digital game companies. And these sort of two very separate, you know, organizations often kind of connect and integrate in certain ways, you know, sort of to create war-themed games and war simulations for recruitment purposes, for training purposes, for propaganda purposes. You can go even sort of looking into the 90s where, you know, this is called for in a policy report by the National Research Council. The report's called Modeling and Simulation, Linking Entertainment and Defense. You know, and it's saying, you know, we can sort of have some sort of mutually beneficial or symbiotic relationship between the military and the games industry for purposes that will help the military and that will also help the sector grow.
I mean, that report kind of really formalizes what was like 30 years of deep collaboration. Like, you know, you read about SimNet and kind of various tank simulators and other kind of games. Also some games that were for public consumption, but then kind of like jerry-rigged or repurposed for the military. I mean, what were some of the kind of main games of that era that the military was using? Both that, there's a couple levels to that, right? There's the level of like simulators and training, but also popular consumption. I guess you could sort of take them one by one, but what were some of the big ones?
What's fascinating to me when you think of the history of the video game as a specific technological artifact or innovation, you see like technically the first video game emerging from like a Department of Defense like funded MIT research lab. And it's really a labor of love. I mean, this isn't something that's direct. It's not something like the DoD wants a video game to be made.
Is that Space Invaders? Which game was that?
Yeah, no, it was called Space War. Okay. And basically, it was just something really, really basic. It was like a computer interface, you know, with a visual cathode ray tube monitor. and basically you turn a little knob and then basically lights flash on the screen before your eyes. But here we have the sort of emergence of interactivity, you know, the hand and the eye sort of are bridged. There's the space of the screen, you know, you turn knobs and all of a sudden there's lights and circles like on the screen before your eyes. And so what you're doing sort of, you know, is having an impact on what you're seeing. And these have sort of interactivity sort of emerging as a result, right? But there's a lot of other things sort of that start emerging in the 70s in particular. There's sort of like video game companies that are sort of getting contracted by the army to sort of work on simulation and modeling. One of the first person shooter games is called Maze War. And this was played on like ARPANET, the sort of US military prototype of today's internet, you know, connecting a bunch of different people in a shared virtual space, you know, in a virtual maze. You could all, everyone be sitting at a specific terminal, but then seeing like different avatars moving on the screen at the same time. You know, it's sort of this interesting sort of new experience emerging. There's also games kind of like Panzer Plato, I think it was called. It sort of, you know, engineered so that tank gunners could hone their killing skills, which then inspired the Atari tank hunting arcade game Battle Zone. Games like that then become commercially sort of repurposed or modified, you know, and then turned back into military simulators for training purposes. You know, there's so much going on. I mean, some of the sort of big games in the 90s, like even, do you remember Doom, where you play as that kind of super marine and you're sort of battling sort of demons from some hell galaxy or whatnot? Doom is basically sort of repurposed as Marine Doom, which becomes very, very popular. So, I mean, there's this history where there's this, again, convergence of games that are commercially popular being sort of reconfigured or modded as games that are functional or useful for military sort of training or recruitment purposes. And then you also have games that start within the military that then sort of get spun off into commercially popular war games. And so there's this two-way flow.
It sort of like strains credulity, though, for me to think that the military thought these games are, you know, actual simulators. I mean, I haven't, you know, played the tank simulators that were just sort of all in-house, but just thinking of Dune, for example, I mean, that's nothing like an actual war. Were these essentially like grifters? Did they really believe that these games were going to help soldiers prepare for battle? Or is this more an ideological project than a kind of training project?
I mean, every war game that claims to sort of immerse a player into the real authentic experience of war is a total grift. It's that itself is a propagandistic premise, because no game can simulate, you know, the actual embodied experience and horror and consequence of fighting a war. And so I see this also then, you know, in terms of preparing people with certain, you know, battle doctrine, strategies, and tactics, it's also very much an ideological project that is, again, integral to the recruitment hard drive. If you can make video games or war video games something that in the public mind feels or appears or is experienced as a real war that we haven't fought, that's going to be pleasurable and fun, your chances of recruiting more people to war are likely going to increase. And that's precisely what happens when the military uses these to recruit teenagers. And so, yeah, very much an ideological project. And you're asking the question about, like, what are the institutions that are concretely engaged in war simulation and modeling? And there's, like, a lot. And there's, like, you know, the Modeling and Simulation Coordination Office or the Modeling and Simulation Enterprise. Basically, it's like it makes war simulation games and it procures the finished sort of products from, like, private developers. There's, you know, the U.S. Army's Project Executive Office of Simulation, Training, and Instrumentation, or POSTRI. You know, this is basically headquartered in Florida's Central Research Park, you know, supports a whole bunch of modeling and simulation projects for the military. There's the Institute for Creative Technology based at the University of California. You know, it was basically built initially with a grant from the military, and I think it still continues to be subsidized by the military. There's Modeling Virtual Environments and Simulation Institute, you know, MOVES, founded at the Naval Postgraduate School at Monterey, California. These are all like concrete, you know, military-supported institutions that are, I guess, spaces of integration between creators, designers, developers, publishers in the actual games industry and sort of those working on these matters in the military.
One of the things that's so amazing with that list that you just sort of rattled off, a lot of those are at universities. And it seems like there's kind of an academic, industrial, military kind of nexus at play here. Why the collaboration with scholars and with scholarly institutions?
It's basically in universities, right, where you have so much research and development happening that often then becomes akin to a subsidy to industry. And so I think if we're going to be honest about the history of innovation, at least when it comes to the so-called digital economy or the computer revolution or whatever sort of phrase is being used to describe the world ever since, you know, computers emerged, we have to sort of move away from this very, very dubious and unsubstantiated, you know, fiction constantly trotted out by sort of Silicon Valley TED Talk, you know, pundits that basically say all of these great wonders of innovation, you know, are brought to you by capitalism and a whole bunch of, you know, tinkerers and dreamers and creators in their garages. But when you actually study the internet, the computer, even video games, the infrastructure, the technological innovations that add to the infrastructure are largely brought to you not by capitalism, but by like DARPA, you know, by the military that's also then working in partnership with public universities and colleges. And so you're creating this kind of nexus, this kind of interaction between the military, between universities and colleges, and then between private companies. And those three are adding to the sort of pool of innovation. I just think that's such an important story to keep telling, because it's a counterpoint to the myths that we often, you know, read and see and hear about Silicon Valley and how innovation happens in society. The state is behind so much, and that's not a bad thing. The problem that I have is that billions and billions of public dollars are being leveraged and allocated to underwrite and undergird some of the most wondrous and incredible innovations that the planet has ever known. And instead of keeping within the public sector and making that a public good and utilizing that to further serve greater public interests, what you have basically is the state and the public sector, you know, handing it over to private capital. You know, the public is being dispossessed of the very innovations that it supported through tax dollars. And it's basically being transferred, you know, in terms of IP rights, patent rights or whatnot, to private innovators that can then go on and exploit it and become billionaires.
Just to give a sense of scale here, I mean, there's a statistic that shows up in your book. I think it said that the modeling and simulation office is allocating something like $4 to $7 billion a year. How much money are we really talking about here in terms of like military support of developing games?
I mean, I don't have the current data, you know, to sort of say what that number has become, but I just sort of would probably say that I think the U.S. Department of Defense budget for 2021 was something like $740 billion. So a few billion in the mix to sort of underwrite or support some, you know, major advances in computer and modeling simulation technologies, you know, that's not a big chunk of change relative to the size of the budget itself.
Right. That makes sense. But it is a big outlay when it comes to the developing games.
Yeah. And again, not all of these games become commercially viable or necessarily even spun off into commercial games. But again, the longstanding link, of the Department of Defense to private industry, the sort of high tech sort of sector, is that, you know, again, money will be shuffled through the Department of Defense into a number of very, very, very risky research and development projects, many that may not even pay returns in the short term or the long term. But because it's a public sector institution and not beholden to shareholders or quarterly dividend payouts, there's much more room for experimentation. And there's much room, arguably, for innovation and risk taking, because people aren't just trying to sort of, you know, trot out the latest version of the iPhone. You know, fiscal conservatives will be like, there's a lot of waste, you know, there's all this money being spent by, and it's true. I mean, there's a lot of like, these projects just don't come to fruition and nothing comes of it. But then you sometimes have a breakthrough, and it's a breakthrough that wouldn't have happened without sort of the sort of, you know, outlays in place and a space institutionally for these developments to be worked on. Because the private sector is very, very short term. It's very present minded. It wants a return on investment. Finance capital wants a return on the money it's spending. And if you can't guarantee a return or at least project it, you're not going to have innovation. So this is, again, one of the contradictions, right? And I'm certainly not here as a spokesperson for the U.S. military's sake. I'm just saying, like, I'm trying to make a case for what the public sector can do. And it's too bad that the public sector of the United States has done so much in terms of innovation, but then not reap the rewards of its innovations. And moreover, driven these innovations forward in the first instance with the pretext of this being about national security, war readiness, and the capacity to drastically enhance the sort of capacity of the United States military to be an effective and efficient fighting machine. I mean, these are the wrong arguments we want to make to support subvention that underwrites technological innovation. But these are the arguments that have been made since World War II.
You're listening to my conversation with Tanner Merlies, Associate Professor at Ontario Tech University and author of Hearts and Minds, the U.S. Empire's Culture Industry. We'll get back to that in a second, but first, a quick message. Our team wants to hear from you. We appreciate when you give us a retweet. We really appreciate when you give us a review, and we especially appreciate when you donate on Patreon. So that's all good, but we'd also like to start a conversation with you. We want your feedback, your episode ideas, your criticism, whatever. We want to know what you think works and what doesn't, so drop us a line. You can contact us anytime at darts@citedmedia.ca or tweet us at @DartsInLetters. Okay, back to my conversation with Professor Tanner Merlies. You'll remember at the top that I said I played a lot of SOCOM US Navy SEALs. So did Tanner. He played it as a researcher and as a critical scholar. But I wondered, did he maybe like the game too?
I feel awkward answering the question because, I mean, every game I think I've played since 9/11, every sort of movie or TV show I've watched about war since 9/11 has been for scholarly purposes, but then I feel quite awkward also recognizing the sort of pleasures that I may feel when engaging with these materials. And it's sometimes like there's like these two subject positions or even three or four that I occupy. You know, it's like the avatar in the game and you're immersed in the story world of the game. And then sort of there's like, you know, me, the sort of analyst, critic, researcher is like, you know, and then there's kind of something else. I just, it's a very strange like mix of dispositions and attitudes, you know, when experiencing these products. And I feel uncomfortable. Like, I mean, I know some game scholars that just can't, or that just refuse to play war games. Like part of their politic is that, you know, to sort of live their critique is to simply, you know, refuse. That's quite principled as well. But then at the same time, I sort of say, well, then how do we learn more about these games if we're simply refusing to play them? But then when we were playing them, we're feeding back into the incentives of the companies that are making them to work with the military and then creating sort of in support, you know. So these are difficult discussions.
I'm curious about that game because I think it represents a lot of these kind of dynamics and the really symbiotic relationship here, because in the development, you have SEALs involved, obviously, and it's doing good public relations for special ops, which, you know, is very important post 9/11 during the war on terror. But at the same time, you also have the game companies and developers kind of benefiting from that involvement, which I think is really interesting because they use the military itself as a kind of sales pitch. And the kind of the realism of the game is what they led with, right? And the fact that SEALs were there and you can read about them in the instruction manual and you can watch the little documentary that they make about how badass these SEALs are. When you write about the game, you write about it sort of like it's realism, but it's hyper-realism. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about that. What makes the game hyper-real?
Hyper-realism was sort of like an old, I guess, 80s or 90s term by Jean Baudrillard, right? And it's sort of this sort of very, very contentious claim that, you know, there's no longer a, you know, distinction between, you know, the reality and its simulation, so to speak. It's become hyper-real. People can no longer sort of discern or distinguish between, you know, the media and entertainment environment that encompasses them and their lives and some truth beneath that, that we could then reveal or uncover through investigation or analysis. And so, I mean, I think that these games are trying to simulate realism, or at least they're claiming to. They're trying to sort of simulate sort of different battle doctrines. They're trying to simulate different, you know, modes of fighting. They claim to sort of, you know, put players in the boots of soldiers to immerse them in sort of, you know, authentically, experientially sort of realistic, you know, wars and battles. But I mean, this is just a bunch of marketing bullshit.
Yeah.
By getting partnership or getting assistance or support from actual existing or retired military personnel, the video game developer and its publisher are able to sort of drum up excitement and interest among all of those kind of, you know, teenagers and sort of older sort of folks as well about sort of this game, about getting closer, getting into, getting, you know, at what the essence of war actually is. And I mean, this is just dishonest. I mean, no game is going to transport any player into an actual war. For a war game to be realistic, to sort of, you know, actually do what its marketers and PR people propose, we'd have to be like shooting bullets out of our TV screens and we'd have to be dodging them, you know, and we probably wouldn't. And then we'd realize maybe like these games aren't so fun and maybe we develop an anti-war, you know, ethos as a result or something.
Yeah. I mean, this marketing here was so ham-fisted. I mean, just to put a finer point on it, like the realism was what sold SOCOM to the extent, you know, at the time, a lot of games, I think, were kind of like quick spawn sort of thing. And the thing that made SOCOM like so hardcore was that you died. And then, I mean, you would come back at the next round, but you'd be in a sort of tight, small squadron. And it really privileged players that played slowly and played stealthily and strategically rather than sort of going Rambo on it. And then in the ads, I mean, the first ad was like three or four guys that are just getting fragged constantly by this team that's just incomprehensibly good. And it turns out that the ad ends with, you know, like basically they're in Bagram or something and it's SEALs. It's actual Navy SEALs playing these teenagers in this ad, suggesting that, you know,
yeah,
it's so
yeah,
real.
Yeah.
The SEALs love it. And obviously that was good for the game because the game was really popular. What did it mean for the SEALs? What did it mean for recruitment?
Yeah, I mean, it just meant that the SEALs had another way to connect to the target demographic of prospective recruits or enlistees. And the game and the advertising and promotional materials surrounding that game become, I guess, another touch point for the military to sort of, you know, reach out and touch, you know, people that it wants to target, it wants to recruit, and that people might have an interest in doing so after playing this game. I mean, you're right. Like, I remember the instruction manual for the game, like, it's like literally there's like a direct recruitment pitch, right? Yeah. At the end of the instruction manual. It's like it says something like, are you interested in a SEAL career? Are you motivated to succeed? Are you determined to persevere? Are you ready to accelerate your life? The SEALs is seeking smart, fit, hardworking young men from all backgrounds to join its elite team of special forces, you know? So like in the instruction manual, you've got a direct pitch from the Navy SEALs. I mean, that's remarkable. And then, it, of course, as you mentioned earlier, there, you know, the pitch in the instruction manual then also has a link to the website and, you know, it's a recruitment portal. And then you can play the game. And after you're done playing the game, you can then watch the recruitment documentary that's also encoded in the main menu screen of the game. Right. The game very much is not just about, you know, fun. It's also about strategic communication and recruitment.
Well, first of all, you know, any kind of anxiety that we might have about sort of American imperial decline, it really kind of helps us feel like no, actually we're pretty badass because the SEALs are incredible. And I think it really kind of sold this operator culture, this kind of like, you know, we are tough, we are badass, we are just like the SEALs, which now in retrospect, you know, I never quite connected it to SOCOM, but now I do after reading your work, because that sort of mentality is now like everywhere with people who like drink Black Rifle coffee and put Punisher logos on their backs. And you have the kind of resurgence of this hyper masculinity online that it seems like a lot of these people just like never recovered from that post 9/11 period. That jingoism just kind of like set in for the kind of people that played SOCOM and just never really questioned it. Like, do you see a connection there between SOCOM and the operator culture of today?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely a connection between the game and that sort of, you know, hyper sort of, you know, chauvinist, masculine sort of identity play. But I think sort of the bigger point to make is that war has always historically been intertwined with patriarchy and, mm-hmm. and with the power and the dominance of men, and has also been sold to young men as a means of realizing and expressing their masculinity. there's this kind of, you know, macho militarism that has been long interwoven with official war propaganda, you know, going back 100 plus years. And I think that sort of video games are playing upon that history, but then sort of extending it or augmenting it in new ways. But what I think we've also seen over the past few years is a bit of a turn in militainment culture to include and integrate, you know, girl power. And one of the films that is a significant example of this is Captain Marvel, which stars Brie Larson. And Captain Marvel was basically assisted and supported by the U.S. Air Force and integrated with the U.S. Air Force's recruitment campaign that is targeting young women. You're seeing really sort of interesting gender sort of roles being constructed and played around with now by the military that are both kind of, you know, traditional, macho, militaristic, chauvinist, sexist. And then you're also sort of seeing the military trying to integrate, I guess, kind of, you know, variants or some simulacra of second wave feminism, at least maybe third, into its recruitment campaign now targeting women as well. And so I wouldn't be surprised if we see more, you know, women being scripted and designed as playable protagonists in these wars in the future.
I'm curious about the prospect of the anti-war game. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of good anti-war movies. In the gaming space, I mean, one game that you wrote about, Medal of Honor Project Anaconda, certainly was no anti-war game, but when it let you play as a terrorist, it got an enormous amount of flack from the military and was eventually kind of essentially censored. I mean, the post 9/11 period was like that. Now there's more space for games, I think, to do transgressive things. Although, I mean, like we've been talking about through this whole conversation, I mean, the militarism is sort of like baked into the DNA of this. So is there space for a kind of anti-war game? Are you seeing anti-war games get developed, and you know, what could that look like?
Yeah, I mean, there were a few developed, you know, in the early 2010s or so. I mean, there was a game called Special Ops: The Line, and it kind of, you know, grapples with the, you know, the horrors of war for civilians who are indiscriminately massacred by, you know, these special forces, and it also kind of like deals with some issues around PTSD among sort of the soldiers themselves, but like, I don't know. This gets overplayed, particularly by conservatives and Republicans that want to sort of delude everybody with the notion that, you know, the culture industry is in some way inherently like radical and left wing or cultural Marxist. And like the very notion that a game that sort of like represents the reality or tries to of PTSD in some sort of shorthand way, or that grapples with the fact that, yeah, civilians do die or are killed in war, isn't like a radical politic. It's just like, it's even like this like basic centrist journalism. It shouldn't be controversial, but the way that people take these, it's like you have to have like a pretty like outrageously vicious, violent, brutal, you know, wargaming culture to come away playing a game like Special Ops, being like, hey, that's a real reflexive, critical anti-war game. You know, it's like watching the 70s movies that were dealing with the sort of fallout of the Vietnam War, and being like, oh, so a video, you know, a movie in the 70s is dealing with like, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder among like the white male soldiers that were sort of fighting that war. And that's called like a left-wing film? Post-traumatic stress disorder is just like an empirical fact. Why is it left-wing or right-wing? It's just, this is what people that fight wars endure or experience. Any gesture of like, these games might have human consequences is seen to be in some way progressive or left-wing. But I'm just like, that says something really, really sad about the kind of society and the kind of culture that we're living in. When the sort of just basic gesture of saying that people die or are harmed or suffer psychologically because of war, you know, becomes associated with something progressive or left wing, just shows, I think, how far right wing and how highly militarized the entire society and culture has become. So I don't see many sort of anti-war games, you know, being played, and at least being played by millions of people. They're simply not popular. I mean, if we wanted to have, a new or revivified sort of anti-war gaming culture, we'd need to start thinking about how to revivify it or build an actual anti-war movement that a video game industry might then start recognizing and channeling and transcoding into new forms of play. I mean, that's, again, not to say that people don't make initiatives already in the gaming industry. There's a game called This War of Mine that casts players, you know, not as soldiers, but as innocent civilians struggling to survive in urban wars that's happening. So, you know, the whole gameplay experience isn't like, you know, shoot them up and blow everything up. It's like, you know, scavenging for food, trying to find shelter from bombs falling. It doesn't have anything to do with killing. It's just like survival is winning. So like, that's interesting. And that's interesting. But again, like, these are novel. They're not the norm. There's not going to be an end to the war games unless there's a massive rolling back of the budgets, institutions, and mechanics of war itself. And there's not going to be an end to any of those until the U.S. is ready to give up its empire. There'll be no end to digital war games unless there's an end to the real wars around the world that the U.S. is continuously fighting in the name of security or transnational capitalist freedom and less the ideal and practice of democracy. You know, like, the anti-war movement has been dead, and I don't say this lightly, but for over 15 years, it was defeated. I mean, it was a mass mobilization. It was organized across cities around the world. There were protests that were larger than anything that history had ever seen in the history of war. And we could not stop the United States from you know, occupying Iraq and continuing with its global war on terror. And I don't think that the anti-war activists from that period have fully sort of been able to recover from that experience or regroup and build something new.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, unfortunately. And you can definitely see it in the games. I think there's no doubt about that.
I sometimes read, whether it be a liberal or conservative, who responds to critical research of the kind that I do and other sort of critical, you know, game study scholars do. Sometimes this is sort of met with a snarky notion that we're taking all of this too seriously, that these are just games. They're just escapist fluff. They shouldn't be taken so seriously as instruments of politics or ideological reproduction. But I just think this is such a ridiculous sentiment, you know, because clearly games are taken seriously by the military. They're taken seriously by the national security state. They're taken seriously as political instruments of military recruitment, training, public relations, propaganda. And the notion that these games are not serious distracts us from how serious their interactive stories are with respect to simulating support for like the worst kind of clandestine operations and coercive tactics. You know, and there's even like, remember Call of Duty Black Ops? Mm-hmm. Black Ops were supposed to be clandestine and secretive, and the public wasn't supposed to know about black operations because the assumption was that if the public knew about clandestine black operations that involved coup d'etats and political assassinations, people would have like a moral reckoning and start being like, that's wrong, and then organize against it. Well, here you have a game that sold millions and millions of copies all over the world that's literally like glorifying black operations. I think you kill Fidel Castro in the game prior to Castro's death. Right? Like, there's actually a level where you kill Castro. With all of that said, I just wonder, like, how would the United States government, how would so many American citizens that are immersed in this militainment culture and loving each and every minute of it respond if Venezuela or Cuba sold millions of copies of video games all over the world that enlisted people in heroic missions to assassinate American presidents, eliminate the 1% that currently run the country, nationalize the big industries, gear production to meet social needs? Like, would such violent video games be dismissed as just like apolitical, you know, entertainment fluff, not like some like radical anti-American, even perhaps even terroristic politics by virtual means? Like, well, I don't even believe the United States would tolerate that. It would close down the free market. It would say, like, you know, this is creative license taken too far. We're going to censor this. And you'd have like uproar and outrage among all of these kind of conservatives. And so there's just such contradiction and such hypocrisy here.
That was Tanner Merlies, associate professor at Ontario Technical University, an author of many books about media, technology, and empire, including Hearts and Minds, the U.S. Empire's Culture Industry. You can find links to his work on our show notes. And that's it for this week's episode of Darts and Letters. Our lead producer is Jay Coburn. Our managing producer is Mark Apollonio. We had research support and show notes from Dave Mosscrop. Our marketing assistant is Ian Sowden. As always, our theme song and outro was composed by Mike Barber. Our graphic designs are by Dakota Koop, and I'm your host and editor, Gordon Caddick. You can send us feedback by emailing the show. The address is darts@citedmedia.ca, or you can tweet us at Darts and Letters. Darts and Letters is supported by our generous patrons. Join us and join them by going to patreon.com/dartsandletters. Patrons get content a day early. This is a production of Cited Media. This episode was part of a wider series looking at the politics of video games. It was given support by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council, and it was housed at the University of British Columbia and Waterloo University. Thanks for listening. Check back in next Friday.